Two things as we get going today. Number one, we now know what Jay Powell is thinking. Number two, do we feel better because of it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 2nd of August. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. I don't know how much more you could want out of a week's worth of economic news than a Federal Reserve rate cut, a jobs report, and, oh, by the way, the trade war getting kicked up a notch. I mean, I suppose you could ask for more, but that would just be getting greedy, so we are going to get right to it. Neela Richardson is at Edward Jones. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you, and I will point out that we learned this morning the economy added 164,000 new jobs last month. The unemployment rate stayed at 3.7%. I will let you pick your favorite factoid out of this morning's report and discuss.
Well, what I love about this report this month is it's basically the economy on a plate. It's everything you need to know about the economy on one page. What we are seeing is that growth continues, that we're seeing job creation, but it's at a slower pace than we saw last year. And we're seeing that manufacturing is adding jobs. But again, you see the weakness from trade seeping in. And finally, you see that business services are holding up. They're the biggest component of the economy relative to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, there is some softness going on. So the economy is still chugging along, but it's losing a little steam and wages are just keeping pace.
Okay, fair enough. So Gina Smilek, let me get to you and transition to Jay Powell, the Federal Reserve this week, of course, cutting interest rates. You were in the room during the chairman's press conference. I was watching, obviously, and it sure read to me like he was trying to say, look, we're going to give you, dear markets, this cut, but don't get your hopes up. Did it read the same way in the room?
I think what he was trying to say is we're going to give you this cut, and we genuinely do not know what comes next.
Hmm.
So I feel like he was trying to leave the Fed's options open to cut again and maybe even a couple more times. But he didn't want to, you know, stoke market expectations that the Fed is about to embark on this long and deep cutting cycle, the sort that you get during a recession. And so I think he was really trying to walk that line between, you know, convincing markets that this is not about, you know, going to be an instance in which we take interest rates all the way back down to zero, while also sort of leaving options open for a couple more cuts.
It's
not clear to me whether he nailed that.
Right. Well, no, totally. Look, and so to that point, Gina, I just want to ask you, as he was speaking, the markets were cratering. Were y'all watching that on your computers as the chairman was speaking?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And actually, one of the Wall Street Journal reporters asked him about it during the conference, which was a painful moment.
I bet it was. So, Neela, to the chairman's thoughts about trade, which you mentioned discussing the jobs report and global weakness. Discuss for me, if you would, the threat that this economy, which is reasonably strong, although fading, faces from global weakness in China and Europe and all those things the chairman said and that we've been saying on this program.
Well, the linchpin of this economic growth, this 10-year expansion, has been the consumer. The consumer has been carrying all the water. And so this latest round of trade tensions, escalation, actually hits the consumer hardest. And that's what's so risky about them. And it comes at a time, starting September 1st, if they actually take effect, that leads right into the holiday season. That's when retailers get about 25% of their sales. So we're hitting the consumer, we may be hitting the retailer, all in one fell swoop. And so it's something to watch and be concerned about. Hopefully, though, it won't materialize and we'll see a deal get done, though hopes are lessening that it gets done this year.
Gina, to that point about the consumer, you had a piece in the paper, either online last night or in the paper this morning, about the Fed working really hard to connect with consumers and the individual worker in this economy because there are things going on that affect them deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've seen this real sea change at the Fed, and it's been an evolution. It hasn't happened all at once, but, you know, over recent years, the Fed has really started to try and talk a little bit more directly to your everyday American worker. And I think they're trying to break out of this image that we all have of them, of being sort of the banker's bank, you know, this organization very much meant to serve high finance, and really drive home the point that, you know, what they do is going to affect whether people have jobs or not and how much their paycheck goes up every year.
All right, Neela, let me get you to the tariffs, or back to the tariffs, since you touched on them briefly. It is, as we will talk about later in this program, 10% tariffs coming the 1st of September unless negotiations prove fruitful on everything else that we import from the Chinese. It's holiday season. It's going to be iPhones to leather to apparel to you name it. This is the bit that consumers are going to feel, yes?
Even toys, Kai, yes, and that's just a shame. Toys. Even toys. This might get consumers' attention. This might lead into some angst going into an election year, which is also another wrinkle in all of these trade negotiations. And so while trade is certainly an elevated risk, it comes at a time where the economy is humming along. And if I were Fed Chair Powell, I would be a little perplexed because not only have I added uncertainty into the markets, my key chief concern, trade, has now been elevated since I spoke yesterday. And so there's still a lot to go on. It's not going to be a quiet August as we all hoped. It's actually going to see a pickup, I think, in volatility towards the end of the year.
Well, right. So, Gina, you know, to the point of the chairman and the president, which could be a podcast or something, I don't even know. You know, Powell comes out and he cuts rates. A day later, the president comes out and does this on trade. We have Powell now on the record saying we don't have a lot of experience dealing with global trade tensions like this. And I'll go back to the thing I said in the open. Do we feel better now that we know what the chairman is thinking?
Yeah, I really don't know. I don't know what we feel. I don't know if anyone knows what they feel.
I don't know if we actually do know what the chairman is thinking right now.
Go ahead. It does put him in a really tough position, though, right? Because do you accommodate a president's trade war, or do you just let the economy kind of flounder? And what Powell has said time and again is that they're really focused on their dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable inflation. But it is this question, you know, if what you do just permits more trade war waging,
right.
I guess,
right.
you know, do
right.
you keep doing it?
Yeah, go ahead, Neela. Sorry, go ahead.
And Kai, the further the Fed strays from that mandate that was just mentioned, the harder it is to maintain its credibility. And that's a key factor.
Right. And that independence, which we talk about all the time. All right. Neela Richardson at Edward Jones, Gina Smilek at The New York Times on a Friday of quite a week. Got to say thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you, Kai.
Wall Street on this Friday. Traders had a little bit of agita, given all that stuff we were just talking about. Down hard at the start, down just slightly less hard at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jobs news at Lowe's this week was not good. The home supply retailer said it's going to lay off thousands of workers, maintenance and janitorial staff. Also, the people who put together the patio furniture and appliances that Lowe's sells. The jobs aren't exactly going away, though. They are just going somewhere else. Third-party contractors, a practice that is becoming common across lots of industries. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Lowe's says its decision to contract out these jobs to workers who likely won't receive health care, vacation, or sick leave will allow the business to focus more resources on customer service, something it sees as key to future survival. It's a strategy that makes sense, according to Arun Sundarajan, a business professor at NYU.
The idea of focusing on your strengths and outsourcing the rest is not new.
What is new? The advent of tech platforms that seamlessly connect companies with contract workers, you know, the Uberizing of everything. Sundarajan says that allows businesses to be increasingly picky about which jobs they want to be in-house and which they'll contract out. And more businesses are contracting out more and more jobs, says Eileen Applebaum with the Center for Economic Policy Research.
This is not simply happening to hourly paid workers or less skilled workers. It's up and down the skill and income ladder.
Everyone from cleaners and security guards to software developers, accountants, and anesthesiologists are more likely to be working contract these days, while high-skilled workers can sometimes do quite well as contractors and earn higher wages. That's not the case for many in the labor force, says Adam Cobb, a business professor at the University of Texas.
for lower skilled workers, this can be pretty darn harmful.
Contract workers generally don't get the same health care, paid time off, or training as regular employees, and they miss out on opportunities to advance through the ranks. Lowe's is offering laid-off workers the chance to apply for other positions at the company, and they claim they have 30,000 openings. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the big issues in this economy today, here in the United States, but also globally, is in very base terms, who has the money, income, and wealth distribution, to be more clinical about it. Thing is, that's not new. In central Mexico, there are two pre-Columbian pyramids that, yes, they are tourist attractions, sure, but also they are rich sources of information about money in that ancient society and who had it. From KJZZ, Jorge Valencia has more.
Adrián Alemán Martínez is crouching next to a mural that's been buried for hundreds of years. He scrapes the dirt off the ground below it with a small trowel.
Primero, debes de tener tranquilidad.
First of all, you have to be really patient, he says. If we do it with a shovel, we'll knock everything off and we won't find anything.
Si lo haces con la pala grande, te vas a llevar todo lo que hay. Ya no vamos a encontrar nada.
Martínez specializes in the delicate work of unearthing buildings and artifacts from the ancient city of Teotihuacan. It's about 2 hours north of Mexico City. This summer, he's working with a team of Boston University archaeologists to excavate this mural and other structures. They contain clues about the life and wealth of laborers and artisans who lived here more than 1,000 years ago. Daniela Hernández Sariñana is a doctoral student at BU.
You have this mix of very nice walls and preserved floors and then not so nice adobe walls.
The civilization of Teotihuacan predated the better known Aztecs. It lasted about 700 years, starting in 100 BC, and it peaked with a population of roughly 100,000 people. Hernández Sariñana says it was a prosperous society.
They had luxury items, mural paintings over here, which we at some point thought we would never find.
At the center of Teotihuacan are two pyramids, which represented the city's political and religious power. But the surrounding areas where workers lived, like where we are today, also showed wealth, says Boston University archaeologist David Carballo.
People were living with nicely frescoed walls, comfortable accommodations, or they had public buildings like temples that brought the community together and were more elaborate.
Carballo says common Teotihuacan folk had access to a high standard of living. He says they engaged in sophisticated trade that was unusual for Mesoamerican societies. They could get jade and mica stones from far south or shells from the coasts.
That's probably why people were migrating to Teotihuacan over its centuries of occupation. This was an economic hub that drew people. It was a religious pilgrimage center, and it was a strong political capital.
Archaeologists generally agree on some clues about how wealth was distributed. Elites and commoners alike lived in large apartments with murals. They all had utensils, like sharpened obsidian glass, that were made using technology that was advanced for the time. Arizona State University archaeologist Michael E. Smith says there was a greater disparity between the rich and the poor in the Aztec and Roman empires.
If you look at a site like Pompeii or Roman sites that have been studied, they had a much greater differences in wealth. The elites controlled more of the wealth.
Smith says we can learn something from Teotihuacan society.
It gives the message that such a thing is possible. You can have a complex urban society without a high level of inequality. That's an observation. That's a conclusion we get from Teotihuacan.
What scientists are debating still is how people in this society were governed. By a king? By a collective government? It's unclear how the economics of the time connected with the politics. In Mexico State, Mexico, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
Coming up,
unicorn sprinkles and all kinds of fancy cookies and different color ice creams.
Summertime. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 98 points today, 0.3%, closed at 26,485. Did the blue chips, NASDAQ down 107 points, 1.3%, 8,004. The S&P 500 down 21.7 tenths%, 29.32. This week, the NASDAQ and the S&P saw their biggest one-week percentage drops since December. For the week, the Dow down 2.6%, the NASDAQ off 3.9%, S&P 500 shed 3.1% on the week. Tech stocks down because of the president's threat on tariffs. Apple shed 2.1%. Chipmaker Broadcom fell by about 2.3%. Exxon's earnings beat expectations, but still had the third quarter in a row of weaker profit. Exxon down 1% on the day. Maybe you're heading to a movie theater this weekend, Friday, as it is. Cinemark banked 4.5% today on strong domestic box office. AMC Entertainment, which reports next week, end of the day up 0.3%. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note, listen to this, down to 1.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood, and I want you to listen to the latest Make Me Smart podcast. This week, we're talking TikTok. The social media app is basically just a continuous stream of short, funny, viral videos. It's super fun. But TikTok is also owned by Chinese company ByteDance. And with China's different laws and norms around privacy, users might want to know more before they sign up.
TikTok has in its Beijing headquarters, they have a room for China's police cybersecurity team. And like I've spoken with many, many thousands of Americans who use social media over the past couple of years, and I think they would feel very differently if it turned out that an American social media app they used had a similar room in this country.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. China is not paying the tariffs. China is not paying the tariffs. China is not paying the tariffs, no matter what the president of the United States says, and he says it all the time. With no real hope that this will put it all to bed, but because facts do matter, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reported it out.
So is the president right when he says China bears the full burden of tariffs? I checked with some economists, Peter Morici of the University of Maryland.
That's false.
Edward Alden at the Council on Foreign Relations.
China pays a very, very small part of the bill.
And Kimberly Clausing at Reed College.
Tariff raised in the early years of the Trump administration, they're being passed on fully to the American consumer.
Up till now, we haven't seen a big spike in consumer price inflation. Clausing suggests one reason, tariffs on imports like washing machines and auto parts have been spread out and diluted, and prices on services haven't been affected.
Typical American is spending over 80 cents of their dollar on things that are domestic. They're things like your health care and tuition.
But the new tariffs President Trump has threatened will hit consumers. They'll be on things like apparel, toys, and cell phones. Now, it's right to say China doesn't pay the price of tariffs. They're collected from U.S. importers as goods come into the country. But that doesn't mean there's no cost to China, says Peter Morici.
The Chinese producers themselves bear a burden in that production is moving offshore, and the Chinese economy sees it in falling investment.
Oh, and there's one more way we Americans are paying, says Edward Alden, as taxpayers.
Aid to American farmers to offset their market losses so far has surpassed the revenue from the additional tariffs. So this has been a net loss even to the U.S. Treasury.
If the newest tariffs on a wide range of consumer goods go through, economists warn rising prices will eat into Americans' recent wage gains from the strong job market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're running a business and watching trade policy being made public tweet by tweet, what are you thinking right now? We got some of our trade regulars on the phone today to find out. We start with apparel because should the president make good on his threat, remember it's a 10% tax on the $300 billion worth of Chinese imports not already being tariffed. If that happens, textiles and clothing are going to get squeezed and hard.
Pretty much everyone I've spoke with had the same reaction, which was some sort of expletive that they said when they saw the tweet.
Julie Hughes is with the U.S. Fashion Industry Association, for whose members timing is everything.
We are at the start now of peak shipping time for holiday selling. So whether it's Black Friday or whether it's Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or whatever you will be celebrating later this year, the product is starting to be shipped now, but it's certainly not going to all be entered into the U.S. before September 1st.
Speaking of timing, there's a whole slew of people who've been dealing with China's retaliatory tariffs for a while already. Ryan Wagner's a soybean and wheat farmer in South Dakota.
I saw the market reaction first. I knew something was up, and anytime you see something like that, you usually check Twitter right away and figured something was going on.
That's true. Wagner's not going to be directly hit by this new round of tariffs unless China retaliates even more. But he figures now the trade war is here to stay, and in a way, the damage, he says, is already done.
Even if the trade war were to end tomorrow and all tariffs were lifted, I don't think any of that business is coming screaming back immediately.
We've talked to Mike Korchmar a couple of times in the past year or so. He's the CEO of his own leather company. He makes briefcases and luggages, that kind of thing. You can color him pro-tariff.
I will note that our business has been helped enormously by the duties on China's production. We're growing and hiring as a result.
And then there are the people whose job literally is tariffs. Gretchen Blau is a customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania.
The tariffs just get passed on to the consumer. It can be very good for us, which is totally the opposite of what I thought would happen. I thought maybe, you know, people would look at different sourcing, but sometimes they just don't have those options. So they have to continue to source from China regardless.
Also, uncertainty, she says.
I have one customer that I was going back and forth with her, you know, making sure that everything was classified properly. And she said, I'm just so confused by all of this. And I reassured her that it's confusing for us as well. And we really need to know all of this.
And some practical advice.
If you're going to do your back to school shopping, get it done right away, because the clothes and the shoes are going to go up.
We ought to say two more things here, really. It's entirely possible the Chinese come back to the bargaining table and those tariffs never kicked in. It's also entirely possible that 10% is just the beginning. To quote the president on the White House driveway this afternoon, I could increase if I wanted to, he said, to a very much higher number. This is, in case you somehow missed it, National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. 120 years of melting all over your hands goodness and big business ever since. Deborah First is a food writer and restaurant critic at the Boston Globe, also an ice cream sandwich aficionado. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And now, honestly, I want an ice cream sandwich after reading this article.
I always want an ice cream sandwich.
That's right. So let's do a little history first. These things are plus or minus 120 years old today, right? I don't think we can pinpoint it, but they were hot from the get-go.
Yeah, they really were. It sort of started off as a craze for the masses. I guess the ice cream dealers started selling them on the Bowery in New York, and you know, you could buy them for a penny, but you had to have exactly a penny because they didn't have time to make change because they were making them so fast because everybody wanted one. And then, you know, the stockbrokers in the upper class saw everyone lining up for these things and decided to start slumming it because they were so delicious.
And here we are now in 2019, and ice cream sandwiches are like one of the hottest foods on social media somehow.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's a mixture of sort of nostalgia. Everybody sort of knows and loves them, but then they've been reinvented in all these beautiful, crazy, colorful ways, you know, unicorn sprinkles and all kinds of fancy cookies and different color ice creams. So they look really good and they taste really good and everybody knows them. So I think they have a lot of appeal that way.
You went out to a factory near Boston, I guess, the H.P. Hood Ice Cream Manufacturing Center or whatever it's called, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's in Connecticut, about a 2-hour drive from Boston. And it's a plant that's been around for a long time now, since the 60s. It's one of the original Hood plants. And, you know, Hood is a maker of those classic ice cream sandwiches. And so, yeah, I got to go and see the ice cream sandwiches being born.
Well, and you had one right off the line, right?
I did. And, you know, it's like so fresh. The cookies are like so crunchy. You know, you can just sort of hear the crunch deep in your inner ear when you bite into one. But you can't you can't eat it the way you would eat a normal ice cream sandwich because the ice cream is so soft. It hasn't been frozen yet. You know, it's basically soft serve. And then the cookies are so crunchy. So if you bit into it, all that soft ice cream would just sort of squish out the sides. So you have to break a piece of the cookie off and then sort of scrape the ice cream out and eat it that way.
You are the food professional, so I'm going to offer my opinion and I'm going to let you shoot it down here. But in my book, ice cream sandwiches are vanilla ice cream only, and you can't have any other thing on the top. No cookies, no nothing. It's just that soggy bready stuff, right?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, it can't be anything else. I mean, all those fancy inventions, they're trash, Kai. It has to be the classic.
Deborah First, she writes on food. She's also a food critic at the Boston Globe. Deborah, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.
Final note on the way out today, just because capitalism never met something it didn't want to mess up. In honor of the aforementioned National Ice Cream Sandwich Day, Oscar Mayer has an offering, the Ice Dog Sandwich. Candied hot dog bits, hot dog sweet cream, spicy Dijon gelato, and a cookie bun. My bologna has a first name indeed. I am not even going to dignify that with a response. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow Industrial's down 98 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ fell 107 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 down 21 points, 0.7%. Lousy week on Wall Street. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.